Welcome to The Inner Circle, the podcast where the Radius Group, a team of experienced wealth advisors, brings you inside the circle of smart financial planning. With a network of industry experts, the Radius Group discusses the latest trends while sharing timeless wealth management techniques. So whether you're looking to optimize your portfolio, minimize taxes, or plan for your future, The Inner Circle is here to provide exclusive and valuable insights.
Well, hello again, and welcome to The Inner Circle, where we bring you smart wealth management insights to try to help you navigate today's financial landscapes. I'm Tiffany Kellner, Managing Director with the Radius Group, and I'm glad you've joined us here for our discussion today. Today, we're diving into a topic that is on everyone's mind, the outcome of the recent presidential election and what it means for investors. With a second-term Donald Trump presidency and the Republican control of the House and Senate, we should see political landscapes change some key economic policies like inflation, taxes, and possibly new legislation. But the big question is, what does this mean for your portfolio? To help us unpack this, I'm joined today with a very special guest, Kurt Ryman. He's the head of fixed income for CIO Americas at UBS Global Wealth Management. Kurt brings a wealth of expertise to this discussion. His career spans decades, including his time as a senior investment strategist at BlackRock and his leadership roles at UBS, where he's guided thematic research and fixed income strategies. You also might have watched him on some top financial news outlets like CNBC, Yahoo Finance, and Bloomberg, where he is a regular contributor. He holds some advanced degrees in business, economics, and international relations. And Kurt, it is an honor to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure to join you, Tiffany. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we are looking forward to hearing all of your insights. So let's get started. So to start things with a second term Trump presidency and a Republican control of Congress, what key economic policies do you think they'll try to tackle first? And how do you think those are going to affect the economy?
Yeah, I think this administration is focused on the folks that got them elected. And by that, I mean how they built on their 2020 performance with what turned out to be a multiracial working class constituency that was concerned about, as you pointed out, about inflation, the broader economy, worried about immigration. These are the key issues. And this administration has been working to bring on board its key cabinet ministers and line them up to be approved as soon as the president takes the oath of office in January. The timing of the policies will vary. The administration is likely to be able to move on tariffs first, picking up some of the playbook from Trump 1.0. There was the phase one deal with China, if you recall, that happened in early 2020. And at the time, China and soon the rest of the world were consumed with COVID. There wasn't much progress on that. And the administration is going to be looking to pick up that storyline, pick up the thread, the pieces of that. There will also be a number of efforts to use tariffs first as a negotiating position. This is an administration that's thinking transactionally and will attempt to get a deal before actually imposing tariffs. So threaten first, see what kind of concessions you can get, and then impose the tariffs later if need be. The other is on taxes. The tax issue is something that was front and center in the campaign. Voters heard that message. That's going to take a little bit more time. I think it's going to be something that happens later in the year, maybe even close to the end of the year. The reason for that is the tax cuts don't expire until the end of 2025, and there's nothing like a deadline to get Congress and the administration motivated. So I think it's that timeline and the difficulty of getting this deal through Congress. Remember, tariffs can be done just through the executive branch. Other items like tax and budget have to go through Congress. So that's going to take a little bit more time, more negotiating. There were a lot of proposals. I'm sure we'll talk about a lot of those in more detail. But in ordering, I think it's those two that are going to be of the top priorities. Immigration will also filter in there to some extent as well. The more that the administration wants to get tough on immigration, more likelihood is they're going to have to get spending. That's an item that has to be approved by Congress. So maybe working initially to on deportations, but in order to do a larger scale deportation, if that's the administration's goal, would require money to get there. So those are some thoughts on, you know, those first key, if you will, economic policy priorities.
Yeah. And, you know, just talking about the increase in the potential for the government spending, as you could imagine, that all starts to bring in inflationary type of conversations. And that's something we hear a lot about from our clients. What kind of policies do you expect from the administration to address inflation? And will these align or possibly clash with the Federal Reserve's approach to interest rates?
I think we all have a certain amount of post-traumatic stress disorder from the inflation of 2021 and 2022. It still lingered into 23, and it's probably, if you know, you could call it having gotten back pretty close to the Fed's target, but still we're all left with the reminders when we go to the grocery store, or if you have the opportunity to buy a car or get car insurance, it's a constant reminder. I don't think we're going to get inflation going back to the levels that we saw, you know, 8-9%. That was inflation caused by too much fiscal policy at a time of pretty severe supply chain distortions. But nonetheless, we do have an aging workforce. We're watching the world become less globalized, less intertwined. And there are other forces out there, like, for example, the cost of migrating to a lower carbon economy, that's not free. So these trends would suggest that inflation is going to have a harder time moving back to target. And the administration understands this and however has certain policies in place that do concern most economists about the possibility of inflation moving somewhat higher. Again, not back to near double digits, but higher than where we are today. Tariffs are widely seen as inflationary, but here's something that I think is worth keeping in mind. If you don't have tariffs rising each year, then it's just a one-time price shock. Inflation goes up for a year and then it settles back. And I think that's what the Fed and others have said when they hear about tariffs. They say typically they're going to look through it. Immigration is a little bit different. When we think about the last couple of years, one of the hallmarks of bringing inflation down happened to be high rates of immigration. We all want immigration to be legal, but in the sense of just thinking about the pressure that we had and saw on wages, that was alleviated by bringing people into the country. If we move the other direction, then that's going to put upward pressure on wages when you look at the unemployment rate that's still hovering right around 4%. This is still a pretty tight labor market, all things considered. So I think what we want to think about here is how these policies are put in place, the ordering, maybe some of the other items that the administration wants to pursue on the deregulatory front or cutting spending or thinking about how to boost energy supply. Those would all tend to pull inflation lower and could offset some of the upward move in inflation coming from other forces. So that's the balancing act. I think the administration, having been elected on a platform of bringing inflation down, is mindful of this and cares about making sure that inflation doesn't get de-anchored. So right now, when we're thinking about the financial implications from all of these policies and the bond market with yields rising, so far, you know, the bond market's not particularly worried about too much more inflation. What we want to make sure is that the bond market doesn't get even maybe more worried about inflation running away. And the reason for that is it starts to have a greater impact on asset classes across the board.
Well, do you see that there could be policy shifts that could potentially influence the fixed income markets?
The bond market has had quite a move. As the probability of Trump taking office grew heading into the election, and then even in the days after the election, bond yields rose. But I think we have to be careful to interpret all of this to just the election. There was a time in the middle of September, you might recall, when the Fed cut interest rates by 50 basis points and people thought the economy was going to go over a cliff and inflation expectations had fallen pretty sharply. A lot of this move higher in bond yields is just a reflection that the economy is in better shape and there's not a risk of deflation. That's a good thing. That's a positive handoff to the next administration, an economy that is in decent shape. And I think the bond market reflects that. Yes, as discussed, there could be a number of policies that could impact the bond market if the administration is not careful. Immigration and tariff policy, together with if there's too much in the way of tax cuts and not enough spending offsets, we could see bond yields rise. But again, the administration looks at financial markets as a barometer of its success. And if bond yields rise too much and that imperils the equity market, then perhaps the administration will start taking a different approach. But yeah, we should be expecting that over the course of the next several years, because of the key appointments that we're seeing being put in place and just kind of understanding that this administration was elected on a policy platform of change, that financial markets are going to reflect this. Right now, what we see is, it's a pretty decent economy. The Fed's still cutting interest rates. There's a lot of artificial intelligence spending. There are just a number of factors that keep us constructive, thinking that the election and the administration is just one of those many factors that influence markets.
I agree with you there. One of the things that looks like the markets really reacted to right after the election in a positive way was kind of centered around the concept of the major tax cuts that President Trump did during his first term. And I know those cuts are set to sunset here in the not too distant future. Do you expect that we'll see an extension of those cuts or an expanding of those cuts? And how do you think the market's going to react to that?
We do think that most, if not all, of the 2017 tax cuts will be extended. This is something that can happen when you have a red sweep. The Senate doesn't have to negotiate with the House, and the administration doesn't have to negotiate with Congress. But that doesn't mean that the administration gets a blank check for every conceivable campaign promise that was announced on the trail. The fact is we have a deficit as a share of GDP that's twice what it was in 2016. That's a constraint on the ability of the administration to put through all of the tax cuts. You think about it, it's not just extending the 2017 tax cuts, but there were also promises to cut the corporate tax rate. There were promises to exempt tip income, overtime income, Social Security income. That starts to get very expensive. Already, just extending the personal income tax cuts is estimated to cost somewhere between $3 and $4 trillion over 10 years. Partisan evaluators of fiscal policy looked at all the campaign promises during the campaign that Donald Trump proposed and thought it might add another $15 trillion. So you can see how, that's including the personal tax cuts. So another $15 trillion is not possible unless there are offsetting spending cuts. And boy, that doesn't leave a whole lot left for government spending. So I guess what I would say is that we think that personal tax cuts will be extended, but there's not a whole lot of room to do a heck of a lot more. It's really pretty constrained. And the reason for that is if Congress doesn't get religion, the bond market could sell off and give Congress religion. And so maybe better to come together and agree on a smaller overall amount of tax cuts, or if you do propose tax cuts, then make sure that there's some sort of offsetting spending cut.
Yeah, and with a Republican-controlled House and Senate, I'm sure that's going to be something we all pay pretty darn close attention to over the next couple years or months and year.
Yeah.
Are there other specific legislative initiatives investors should pay close attention to, like the deregulation, infrastructure spending? You said something about energy policy shifts.
Right. So what I was wanted to say but haven't said yet is, even though it's a United Congress and a sort of red sweep in DC, these are pretty narrow majorities as they come. We're 52, 53 Republican seats in the Senate. There's still, I believe, one outstanding decision. We have just over 218 seats, which is what you need for a majority in the House. And really, over the last 4 years, anytime you've had unity within Congress, or even if you haven't, you've seen defections. Under Biden's first 2 years, there were two senators that were not excited about some of the fiscal policy programs, Democratic senators. And so those defections made it more difficult for the Biden administration. A similar dynamic could occur in a Trump administration if the requests are seen as being maybe too far afield, maybe too much spending. Any member of Congress who's concerned about the deficit, and there still are some, then they may be more vocal. Those moderates or fiscal conservatives may be more vocal and constrain the legislative ambitions. I think that this Congress is going to, you know, really have its mind set on taxes for the first year. And then we'll see where they get to on border security. That actually could even be another first year policy win, given that there was some visible agreement in the 118th Congress, the last Congress. Deregulation and energy policy, those are likely going to come out of the executive branch. That's going to be more the purview of the administration. Doesn't necessarily require that Congress vote. And so we do think there will be extensive deregulation in the economy. That was already in train from the summer when the Supreme Court reversed a decision from 4 decades ago that had given the administration pretty wide remit in interpreting legislative statutes. The Supreme Court pulled that back and said, if the administration's not following the letter of the law, then we're not going to let the administration just decide whatever it thinks is the right scope. So there's areas that I think the Trump administration could pursue to deregulate that's consistent with that Supreme Court decision to reverse what's called Chevron deference. And this may show up in the energy sector as one area where maybe the administration under in the past is would be perceived as having overstretched their authority. And this administration will want to bring things back a bit, deregulate, you know, reopen markets, reopen access points for the industry. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But that's something that we think that was promised on the campaign that has really some potential to play out over the next 4 years.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how all of those play out. And anytime that you talk about changing in legislative ideas and the concept of types of changes in Washington in general, you certainly see a market react to that. Elections overall, the outcome can create a lot of market volatility. But that doesn't necessarily mean you should leave the market. You know, certainly volatility causes a lot of anxiety, especially during emotional elections like this. Can you share your perspective on why staying invested through political transitions is so critical and how investors should best position themselves for the long run?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, and just this whole year, it doesn't matter which side you chose. It was a pivotal decision. And I think both Republicans and Democrats looked at this as something of an existential moment. And so you could imagine at any point over the course of this year, wanting to vote with your portfolio if you thought that it wasn't going to go your way. And yet look at where we are. This year, just a balanced portfolio, a moderate, may call it 60-40, globally diversified portfolio has yielded somewhere between 11 and 12%, which is pretty impressive. I mean, that's a, you know, that's a really good number. And so what happened if you decided at the beginning of the year that you just couldn't take the pressure and you decided to put everything in cash? Well, okay, you know, what you maybe got, you know, if you had a CD 4.5%, 5%, you're substantially underperforming. And that's the key here is if you have goals and objectives and you're, you know, you've set a strategic asset allocation with your advisor and you've crafted that with a mindset towards the volatility that you can assume over, you know, whatever period of time, then there's no reason to abandon that because maybe, you know, something happened in the election cycle that, that you didn't like. I can go back in time, you know, and I can pick on both parties. You know, if I, if you didn't like the outcome in 2008, you started in March of 2009, one of the most epic stock market rallies in history. So if you sold and went to cash then, you would have missed out. And in 2016, when Donald Trump took office, the same thing happened. If you sold and went to cash, you missed out on a very important move higher in the stock market. So, you know, I would say don't let your, you know, politics mix with your portfolio, keep them separate, work with your advisor, establish that strategic asset allocation that works for you. It's kind of that all-weather portfolio with the volatility that you can assume, you're willing to assume. You know, I think there are actually some really good things that we have today that we haven't had in recent elections. You know, I can talk about, you know, a five-year just government bond that yields a little over 4%. That's fantastic.
You know, yeah, like that's great.
We haven't had that in a while, you know? So there are really good things here. And so I would just say, hew to your strategic asset allocation, make some tactical shifts here and there based on where there's some opportunities and use that time-honored tradition of making those changes where you see fit, but staying invested.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I think too often when you have presidential elections like this that, you know, really encompass so much attention a year and a half before the election actually happens, it's so easy to get so focused on what's happening today. And it's so important to just pause and take a step back and look at it from a bigger picture and realize that there's a lot of history when it comes to elections and things that move the market. And when you look at it from that bigger picture, the market continues to trend positive. And I think that that's what you have to keep in the back of your head when it comes to making decisions. Thank you, Kurt, so much for joining us and sharing all of your insights today. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
For all of our listeners, we hope this discussion has provided valuable perspective and served as a reminder that navigating market changes, whether they're driven by elections, policies, or other factors, it is all about staying informed, being disciplined, and focusing on all of your long-term goals. At the Radius Group, we're here to help you align your financial strategies with your goals, no matter what the political or economic environment looks like. If you have any questions or want to discuss how today's conversations relate to your specific situation, please don't hesitate to reach out. Thank you for turning into the Inner Circle. Until next time, this is Tiffany signing off.
Today's episode features financial advisors with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA, SIPC, located at 3601 Rigby Road, Miamisburg, Ohio, and can be reached at radiusgroup@ubs.com. This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary.